Hello, I am Pete Real, a high school English and Spanish teacher, an avid reader, and an aspiring writer. Thank you for listening to the Chills at Will podcast, in which we explore the visceral beauty of literature and its connection to our culture, our history, and ourselves. Today on Lucky Episode 13, I will discuss mad writer skills. Mad writer skills. Do you ever read a text that makes you salivate? Where you reread line after line because the writer's talent shines through so brightly? Speaking for myself, after the first wave of thrill, I get past my next emotion of jealousy and find myself in awe of the writers who, whether immediately or after much revision, yes, it's most likely the latter, are able to craft such breathless and breathtaking prose. Today's episode will feature the young and gifted writer Ocean Vuong, the late great David Foster Wallace, and the godfather, the padrino, the inspiration for this podcast, Tobias Wolff. First writer we'll discuss today is Ocean Vuong, a writer who I think of as a child prodigy, since he was garnering attention early on with his college writing, and is now in fact a college professor himself, in addition to a highly decorated and awarded writer at the fairly newbie age of 32. I highly recommend his novel, On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous, and if you're hoping that the book will be as breathtaking as its title, you're in luck. While reading his book, I should have kept tabs on how many times I stopped to reread a line or a sentence, or to see how the writers so skillfully weave together phrases and clauses and seemingly disparate scenes. Reading his prose is truly a pleasure. Here are a couple examples, out of context, seemingly needless of context, before I focus in on one of his thrilling excerpts. And I quote, "Because the sunset, like survival, exists only on the verge of his own disappearing. And, to be gorgeous you must first be seen, but to be seen allows you to be hunted. And, too much joy, I swear, is lost in our desperation to keep it. And, I miss you more than I remember you." See? Mad skills. If I had a mic that was easier to maneuver rather than the one that's fixed to the stand in front of me, I'd definitely drop it. If I could snap, I would, with the intensity of a 1950s beat. If I could snap, yes, you heard me correctly, I can't snap, alright? And no, you're not going to be able to teach me. Little John wrote a song about me trying to help. Plus, I've had hundreds of people over my life try to teach me, and none have been successful. But back to Ocean Vuong, whose very name is rhythmic, flowing, sorry, pun unintended, curiosity-inducing, and beautiful. In On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous, he writes, "Sometimes being offered tenderness feels like the very proof that you've been ruined. Sometimes being offered tenderness feels like the very proof that you've been ruined." While the context of this line matters, I want to focus today's episode on the standout skill of these writers, which, in context or out, stands out so prominently that they're thrilling and chilling and awe-inducing even on their own. Vuong speaks to me, and to so many others, when he writes about the nature of receiving compliments, or receiving what we may see as mercy. Tenderness truly can be taken wrongly by people, those who see it as pity for the undeserving. I immediately think of my students, teenagers in high school, though this, of course, can affect any of us. I think of how this mercy, this pity, this tenderness is seen as somehow less pure because we as the receivers, fueled by our lack of self-esteem, feel it to be unwarranted or forced, a participation trophy of sorts. Tenderness, love, devotion, unselfishness aimed towards you. While these qualities might not be the exact same thing, they're very similar to compliments in that they're often hard to receive fully without asking, consciously or subconsciously, why me? I often say, only half-jokingly, that high schools should offer a class on how to receive a compliment. Think about all the shields that me and you and others have used to block a compliment. Oh, come on, you're exaggerating. I didn't do that well. No big deal, that test was easy. Anyone would have done the same. For Vuong's protagonist in On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous, this tenderness shown by another only serves to highlight the ruins of a psyche that needs that tenderness, that demands it, if only for some sort of spiritual boost to even approximate normalcy. In this way, then, one's tenderness can unearth old wounds, stunt independence, or paradoxically, stunt growth. To hear Vuong's beautifully poetic and descriptive and meditative line, sometimes being offered tenderness feels like the very proof that you've been ruined, is to stop and reflect. Before digging below the line's surface, finding the T word that's been hiding there all along and is the catalyst for so much of our world's misunderstandings and anger and shame. And that T word is trauma. If only my writing could be as gorgeous as Ocean Vuong's, even ever so briefly. David Foster Wallace is someone who I discovered later in life. A few years past my college days, and reading his work was like me listening to Sublime right after Bradley Nowell died, and flogging myself for someone being so late to the game. David Foster Wallace was a man with so much to say about pop culture, TV especially, about grammar, about loss, about grief, depression, the excesses of modern society, about language and literature itself, that it boggles the mind to read his copious footnotes and lengthy correspondence with fellow authors, and his 1,079-page tome, Infinite Jest, and have even an inkling about how busy and buzzing his mind must have been. David Foster Wallace, sadly, committed suicide in 2008. I've been so moved by his writing, so dumbfounded by his humor, by his accuracy, by his breadth, that I have huge parts of his writing memorized, in the vein of this podcast, to give myself chills at will. I have big plans, but I also have a full-time job and 2 kids, 4 and under, and a life. But I have big plans to do another podcast in the next year or two, that is solely based on David Foster Wallace's essential and riveting text, A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again. This essay is incredible and hefty, coming in at barely under 20,000 words, with each page full of witticisms, subtly depressing statements, blatantly depressing statements, laugh-out-loud humor, self-deprecating and therefore funny anecdotes, as well as razor-sharp observations. As I say, the piece is so illustrative of Wallace's ability to meld the heartfelt, the earnest, the self-flagellating, along with some straight-up writing humble brags, some tangents that seem to be there just to display his prodigious skill. Don't get me wrong. I love these tangents. I love his copious footnotes that often take up a half a page or more just on their own. But it does, at times, seem like his writing is a literary equivalent of, "Look, Ma, no hands." So the line that I'm featuring today is incredible, in and of itself. And not too much context is needed, I don't think, for you to see and hear his considerable talent. But before the main course, here's a nice appetizer from Wallace's same essay. This is simply one of those thoughts that may never have occurred to you so plainly, but that the author so acutely captures that you are quick to think about how right he is. And I quote, "Men after a certain age simply should not wear shorts, I've decided. The skin seems denuded and practically crying out for hair, particularly on the calves. It's just about the only body area where you actually want more hair on older men." End quote. I mean, come on. "Men after a certain age simply should not wear shorts, I've decided. The skin seems denuded and practically crying out for hair, particularly on the calves. It's just about the only body area where you actually want more hair on older men." Gentlemen who happen to be listening to this episode, tell me that you didn't just now look down at your lower leg. And if you're a bit older, if you're of a certain age especially, that you didn't notice that Foster Wallace is right on. That there is indeed a dearth of hair, especially close to the ankle, that seems incongruous with the rest of the leg. I speak to you as a hairy-legged Italian, and I have to say that though Foster Wallace never met me, he has absolutely nailed my lower calf weird hairlessness situation. This is a writer with a perceptive and powerful writing style who couldn't manage to hold back such writing prowess even if he wanted to. Okay, now that the hairy-legged antipasto is done, on to the main course. In the essay mentioned, Foster Wallace writes about a Caribbean cruise that he took in 1995 aboard the MV Zenith, which he so cleverly calls the MV Nadir, N-A-D-I-R. He details the personalities of countless guests and workers, the activities and manufactured fun aboard the ship, and his own uneasiness and queasiness aboard the ship. At one point, he details the onboard library, such as it is, describing it as follows, and I quote, "Only one wall is even shelved, and most of the books are the sort of books you see on the coffee tables of older people who live in condominiums near unchallenging golf courses. Folio-sized, color-plated, with titles like Great Villas of Italy and Famous Tea Sets of the Modern World, etc." End quote. What the heck? Wow. WT heck. To summarize, in the middle of that quote, he says, "The sort of books you see on the coffee tables of older people who live in condominiums near unchallenging golf courses. Not just golf courses, but unchallenging golf courses. These are the sort of books you see on the coffee tables of older people who live in condominiums near unchallenging golf courses." The specificity of this sentence is so audacious and so right on. I've been to older people's houses, of course, maybe even a condominium in which older people live. And I've been to houses near golf courses, perhaps even unchallenging ones. And yes, I've seen the exact sort of books Foster Wallace mentions, those larger-than-life books that are often in prominent positions in Barnes & Noble, the type that probably have never been read cover to cover in one sitting, but always nibbled at from time to time. These are books that have beautiful and glossy photography, a good amount of fluff, and not a lot of unifying narrative. They're books whose presence on Grandpa and Grandma's coffee table is as calming, permanent, and taken for granted as is your ease in their presence and in their home. I do not know that I've ever been in a condo, however, that can currently match the trifecta Foster Wallace lays down, Number one, with these particular books on a coffee table. Number two, in the house of an older person. And number three, which is near an unchallenging golf course. I know, though, that if I were to be in this specific place, Foster Wallace is exactly right, and that the books on the coffee table would be exactly as he has described. There is such a definitive skill in creating a literary environment that reminds readers of a situation or place where they've been. But here's what Foster Wallace does in this particular case. He creates a world where you have not been, but where you can feel and certify his precision and authenticity, which shine through so robustly. There's so much to unpack in just a little, otherwise throwaway sentence in a larger piece, and Wallace's skill shines through so brightly with his keen eye for detail. I think, I'm not sure though, that my favorite part of the sentence is the unchallenging golf courses. This modifier, unchallenging, stimulates in my mind, like a domino line, the idea of older people retiring to a sort of community where golf courses and other accoutrements are showpieces, part of the price of admission to a comfortable period of old age for someone who is not weak and decrepit, but desirous of a life of well-deserved ease. The golf course is not for the person trying to hone his game, not for the one ready to work on her putting, or the one who wants to hit the PGA Tour with Tiger soon. It's an accessory, like the pool and decorated weight room, which is curiously devoid of many exercise machines. All this because Foster Wallace describes a couple of monster-sized books in a makeshift library on a cruise ship. Ah, to be like Foster Wallace, who with a hyper-focused diction can bring to life so many other trains of thought, so many divergent and interesting paths, and so much inescapable truth. The last writing that we'll explore today is from the Chills at Will podcast, OG. Capo de tutti capi, Mr. Tobias Wolff. While Foster Wallace's excerpt was clever, fairly innocuous, and placed into subtly serious text, Wolff's line brings some incredible seriousness, universality, and subtle historical connection into a previously unique and specific storyline. The storyline of his masterful short story, The Chain, is, as expected from the title, a bit complicated, yet its story is one who's worthy of an exploration for a whole episode. I'm convinced that I will come back to this story for a later episode, so I'll leave aside much of the plot summary at this time and focus in on the mad skills of the writer himself, as seen in this beautiful and touching and sad and brilliant and apt and tragic line. Brian Gold, raised Catholic and with his family considering itself Irish, is the protagonist of The Chain. His last name, though, stands out in his mostly Gentile town, and he's hyper aware of his Jewishness that came from his dad, who divorced his mom early on in Brian's life and has not been in touch with the family. Brian feels weak and impotent in a situation where his little girl is badly injured and almost killed by a neighbor's dog off its leash. Brian's cousin, named Rourke, plays the instigator, the Tom Hagen to Brian's Frankie Pantangeli from Godfather 2, even comparing the neighbors, who haven't even made an apology or any sort of restitution to the family for the dog attack, to Nazis. This trips a circuit in Brian's subconscious, leading him to ruminate once again on his own qualities that he's ashamed of and that are often fodder for anti-Semites. While he realizes the logical fallacy in believing racist tropes to be, even in a minute way, true and worthy of shame for the victim of the bias, cannot seem to help it. And Wolf writes of how the history of the Holocaust, subtly or not, informed Brian's views and his behavior. Wolf writes, with the practiced and targeted pen of a historian and a student of human nature, and I quote, in the already familiar picture that Rourke had conjured up of Jews being herded by dogs, Gold sensed an instance of the resignation that he disliked in himself. He knew it was unfair to blame people for not fighting an evil that their very innocence made them incapable of imagining. Yet even while admitting they were brutalized and starved and in shock, he couldn't help but wonder, why didn't one of them hit a guard, grab his gun, take some of the bastards with them, do something? Even in his awareness of the terrible injustice of this question, he never really laid it to rest. End quote. I'm blown away by this passage, and I want to particularly hone in on the middle portion. Quote, he knew it was unfair to blame people for not fighting an evil that their very innocence made them incapable of imagining. End quote. Oh man, does Wolf have skills? I'm so struck by this idea of blaming people for an evil that their own innocence or purity or naivete makes them incapable of even imagining or even cobbling together in their minds. Because yes, who could have ever in their right mind have imagined the Nazis and the Holocaust even existing in real life? Who could have summoned forth a non-fiction storyline in which people were made into human guinea pigs, lab animals, horror movie-esque skeletons, and put to death in the most gruesome and unexpected ways? And yet there are still those today who, and I'm setting aside even the Holocaust deniers here, there are still those today who believe that the Nazis were right, that the Jews were deserving of their fate, a fate that crept up on them in stops and starts until the Holocaust killed literally one-third of the world's Jews. The Holocaust couldn't possibly have happened. The world could not possibly have been so craven, so indifferent, so complicit, and so blind. But it was. And Tobias Wolff's writing is so real, so revelatory. He knew it was unfair to blame people for not fighting an evil that their very innocence made them incapable of imagining. In smaller ways, in less serious ways, although isn't everything less serious when it's compared to the Holocaust and that tragedy, in smaller ways we often do blame those, directly or indirectly, who were victims. Look at Rihanna, a woman who was a victim of domestic violence at the hands of Chris Brown. Well, what'd she do to provoke him? I heard people say at the time. Various victims, including many homeless, many accusers in the Me Too vein, crime victims who become victim-blamed. Wolf is able to, in so few words, chip away at a fairly vague concept until it becomes crystal clear, frightening, and chill-inducing. I mean chill-inducing in both the positive way in which this podcast operates, and in the chilling, stare out the window and think way that brings out the most somber pessimist in all of us. Thank you for listening to Lucky Episode 13, Mad Writer Skills. I hope you are in as much awe as I am of Mr. Wolf's, Mr. Foster Wallace, and Mr. Vuong. I did toy with making this episode 14, in the same way as some superstitious hotels don't have a 13th floor, only a 12th and a 14th. But hopefully this 13th episode will bring me luck in having you, dear listener, subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and leave me a 5-star review. You can also ask for the podcast by name using Alexa and find the pod on Spotify starting August 5th. You can follow me on Instagram, where I'm at Chills at Will Podcast, or on Twitter, where I'm at Chills at Will PO1. That's PO, the digit 1. That's all one word. This is a passion project of mine, a DIY operation, and I'd love for your help in promoting what I think is a unique and spirited look at an often ignored art form. You can find the literature reference today in Ocean Vuong's novel, On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous, published by Penguin Press in 2019. You heard correctly, it's a very contemporary book, 2019. David Foster Wallace's essay, A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again, can be found in A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again, Essays and Arguments, published in 1998 by Back Bay Books. Tobias Wolff's The Chain is from the July 1st, 1996 issue of Esquire magazine. It can also be found in his collection, The Night in Question. The intro song, which I'm happy to debut today for the Chills at Will podcast, is Wind Down, instrumental version. And the other great song played on this episode was Simple Math, instrumental version, by Jake Hawes, H-A-W-S. And that's used through archesaudio.com. Arches Audio is one word with two capital A's. For now, thanks again for listening, and I hope that these quarantine days bring you texts written by writers with mad skills, whose work gives you chills at will. Thank you.